of general curiosity, I'm a creative visual artist, making like observational. Oh, hi.
Oh, do you mind if I?
No, it's fine.
Tandem.
Video, yes.
Fly on the wall.
Yeah. Observational video, and I actually want to start talking to people, and this is, which I haven't done, and this is kind of my entrance to kind of figuring out different methodologies.
Great. I'm Jasara. I live in Montreal, and I work as a journalist, so interested in storytelling and histories and people.
My name is Annabelle, and I'm a news coordinator at the community radio station at York University in Toronto. And I'm just, I don't really have much experience doing oral history, but I've always been really interested in it, and especially in terms of providing historical context to community news. And I'm particularly interested in how to best approach what Zion was saying, people I don't know, and also doing community outreach. So having it be kind of a community project versus like the radio station just saying like, give us your story. I want people to be like, oh, I'll ask my neighbor and have them kind of participate, mm-hmm. mostly.
My name is Alan Skerritt. I'm a member of the WGXC Council. I'm originally from the New York City area. I lived in Brooklyn and Queens and Manhattan. I have grandparents, however, here in the cemetery, and I'm 73 years old. So I take a lot of ownership for this community, this county, and have known it over the years as someone who came to visit for vacations in the summertime. I worked here in the summertime, golf courses and those kinds of things. My interest in the oral history preceded the evolution of the WGXC. There are several people in Columbia County who I have known for some years who have a wealth of invaluable history of African Americans in Columbia County and Hudson, New York. And one who lives in Greene County, name is Charles Swain, he knows where all of the Underground Railroad stops were along the river. I mean, these kinds of things. And there's a woman named Marcella Beagle here who runs the RSVP program, which is assistance to senior citizens, of which I am now one. I'm on that advisory board as well. And through talking with Marcella and talking with Mr. Swain in the past, and one other woman who my mother grew up with, who's now 90-something years old. Boy, what a wealth of history there is these people contain. So I would like to, since we now have a radio station, to kind of, you know, take the ideas that some of us had before, years before, in putting together this oral history package, which, by the way, after 1947, there isn't any. There is no history documented of the African American living in this community since 1947. Now, 1947, I was 10 years old. So that just goes to show you what kind of community that we're living in here. There isn't a community in this county that isn't either racist or bigoted. One or the other. There isn't one. Anyone claims that there is one, please raise your hand. Okay, thank you very much.
I'm Shiver Winstone. I worked for KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley back in the 70s and didn't think of it as oral history when I was doing women's programming and interviews with people, many on historic issues, but I kind of was doing that and broadcasting work. Interviews that other people, such as Studs Terkel, mm-hmm. did also back then, and I hope to get back into it sometime in the near future, ideally in Europe as part of learning a language and a new culture if I ever win the lottery and move there.
My name is Jen Lawhorn. I'm from Richmond, Virginia. I drove my car 8 hours to get here. I came here to see a lot of people that I like and care about and to meet this radio and to experience my first Prometheus barn raising.
I'm Laura. I just moved to Catskill, and I work a lot with young people, and I'm interested in doing oral history projects with young people and older people, bridging gaps between the generations, but going both ways, so it's not just young people hearing older people's stories, but older people hearing younger people's stories, and really interested in ways to pique interest and kind of get those kind of projects started, and specifically hopefully working with Matt, who built a people's museum in Catskill and doing displays and recordings for that project.
I'm Matt, also in Catskill, and just completed this large bobcat-shaped kind of open-air museum that, to talk, well, Charles Swain actually, you know, appeared. I called him out because I met his son at the stick dump, and he turned out he had a photograph of the site before the buildings got knocked down that his uncle had a store in, so there's a photograph of that. So kind of just being there working at this vacant lot and, you know, talking to everybody and presenting everything on an equal level, the historians next to just the persons walking by. So it's a big kiosk, dawn to dusk, it's open. Just go in there at any time.
My name is Sarah, and I live about 15 minutes from here, and I work with WGXC. And I have been involved in one oral history project before. I was living in California, and it was this sort of major mapping project that had a audio component that I wasn't so involved in. But that was on the Mexico-U.S. border. And it was something that I like really poured my heart into, and it's a really different geographic and political context. But I'm really excited to be maybe working with some of the people out here to think about what we can be doing.
There are a few more people who came in triple, and if you want to say something about your interests or who you are. Okay.
My name's Eli, and I'm originally from Kansas, but I'm working on putting roots down around here. And I spent a lot of time hanging out with some really strong grandmothers who taught me a lot. And I think it's really, like, for me and my generation, we're, like, starting to lose that generation of our elders, and I feel like it's so important. And, like, amnesia is such a powerful tool for those who, like, profit off people's exploitation. It's, like, for people to be collectively forgetting these stories and these histories. And I feel like it's so important to be combating that and have a passing of the hat of the generations. And I've worked a lot with youth and worked a lot with elders, and I feel like bridging that gap is really important. That's where a lot of the work is, and like in holding and building our collective memory, which is our strength and defense.
So I'm going to start with what we have so far, because in this room, if we all were to go out and do some oral histories, we have an amazing archive right now. I've heard issues of family history, interest in using oral history in educational settings, interest in ethical issues. I've heard community history. I'm going to talk a little bit about the difference between a community history and community-based history. Do you want me to hold that or put that to you?
That's fine.
Really? Okay. So basically, I want to start talking and going through these sheets that I gave you. And if you came in late, there's enough to share, but I'm happy to send you one so you have your own after the workshop. That was really helpful to me. What I'm going to be doing is talking to you about some of the projects I've been involved in as examples of certain kinds of projects. If you at any point want to raise your hand because you have a different kind of project and you've had that same problem, or you want me to address something specifically, I'm happy to do that. So please, as we're going through this, let me know where you want to slow down or speed up. So I'm going to start at the top with the term oral history, because we all had enough of an understanding of what it is that we all wanted to be in this room together, but it's a term that's thrown around in so many different ways, and we're going to be defining it here for our conversation as an oral AU document, always as the audio. So when you get a transcript of an interview and someone says, here's an oral history, we're not calling that the oral history. That's a transcript. An oral history is always the audio document. A transcript is a map or a guide to that conversation. And there's so many reasons. The reasons we're using audio and oral history are to capture things like intonation, velocity of speech, sarcasm, silence, all these things that can be lost in a transcript and that are really impossible to fully document in a transcript, though people are coming up with ways to preserve some of that. But we're starting out as oral historians thinking that the audio, actually what happens in speech and sound, is primary. So the transcript is not the oral history. It's the audio document. An oral history, in the most purest sense, is the full audio document. Once it's produced and edited, it's either radio doc or documentary, but we also place some value on the full oral history. So what I like about the sound of some of these projects and some of the radio shows, I think, Kieran, you mentioned the agriculture, is that we can create an archive. We can create a group of long interviews that can still live at the station, at the local library, in the school system, even if we go and make things from those oral histories. I think it's really important that we think about the value of that full hour interview, even if you're going to edit it down to 5 minutes. So you're always creating an oral history archive, even if you're then taking that and making a monologue like Studs Terkel, or you're making a radio documentary. You're always thinking that that full audio document is significant. Now, I just want to start talking, like I'm going to use some terms so we can all start using them to differentiate between different kinds of oral history projects. So a community oral history project is different than a community-based oral history project. So a community oral history project is about a community. A community-based oral history project means it's done by the community. So I could go to a community as an outsider and do an oral history about a town. But a community-based oral history means it's always done by insiders. So there's an insider-outsider issue. So I worked as a consultant on a public health oral history project, and I think this relates to some of the things some of you were talking about in terms of your goals. The project related to a very polluted body of water between Brooklyn and Queens. And on both sides of that polluted body of water, there were high incidences of leukemia, very rare forms of leukemia, and other public health problems, but Queens and Brooklyn folks weren't talking. They were organizing on both sides of the creek. So the idea was to train people in the community to interview one another and create what we called community health and harm narratives. And this was a public health study. I was brought in as the oral history person. And instead of getting a bunch of numbers to crunch, we decided to take anecdotal evidence. And that's what all oral history is. It's anecdotal evidence. Sorry. So we decided to take all these stories and to find themes that were coming up in every interview. If everyone says there's a smell on Thursday morning in this spot, that's something insiders know, but an outsider who comes for one day to test the air isn't going to know. So oral history is starting with the idea that people who don't normally get a voice, get a voice. And that's always who you should be prioritizing in terms of your oral history projects. That doesn't mean that we don't have oral history projects about presidents or other people that are considered elite in some way. But the true heart of oral history is that it's history, what we call history from the bottom up. So it's giving voice to people who don't get a voice. That includes people who have literacy issues. Oral history is great for people who either don't want to write things down, don't bother to write things down, or don't trust things that are written down. So Studs Terkel, who was invoked earlier, is a person who called, you know, oral history, history from the bottom up. It's a very Marxist form of doing history. So you want to be thinking about, when you have your idea, I want to do an oral history about such and such, who has not been interviewed? That should be your first question, who has not been interviewed? And, you know, I didn't mention, I'm a new member of this community in Hudson. I live a block away. I've been here a year and a half. And I'm starting to think about oral history projects that interest me here, and I'm excited to work with WGXC. And there's certain issues that I'm hearing about, but I'm not hearing about from the perspective of the people inside the story. So I'm starting to think, well, who has not been interviewed in this town? And regardless of your story, you want to be thinking about who has not been interviewed. Other kinds of oral history projects that exist, You might want to do an oral history project about a social movement, a political movement, an event, a family history, a life history, which we'll talk about, an institutional history. So there are factories here that have shut down. We might want to do an oral history about an institution that either is about to close or has closed, but there are still people living in the community who can tell you about a particular factory in the area and how it shaped the community, how it shaped who came to the community for those jobs. You can do an oral history project about a labor force. I've been interviewing toll booth collectors on the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, which also is an institutional history since they will unfortunately eventually be gone and will be fully mechanized there. You might do an oral history project about a musical tradition or musical genre, something that's already oral in nature. You might do an oral history project about a shifting population. And this is something that I think might be really important for lots of you. Oral history is great for documenting transitions, transitional populations, things that are changing, because you can come back to the story. So just to give you an example of a project I worked on through the Columbia University Oral History Archive, which is the oldest archive in the country and is open to the public. I recommend if you're in the city and you have a few hours to listen to things, go ahead. So their 9/11 project, instead of documenting what happened, they wanted to document memory and trauma. So we interviewed people in 2001 and then re-interviewed them in 2002 and asked the same exact questions. So that means I asked someone in 2001, in October, what did you see on that day? And 2002, a year later, I asked the same question and the answer was completely different. And we were studying not only the ways that trauma and memory, what occurs in traumatic situations, but also what happens within a year in terms of conflating informational sources. So one of the things that oral history is really great at, that I'd like to say without offending journalists in the room, that journalism is less concerned with, is establishing social networks. So that means that when you do an interview, you say, who else should I talk to? Where did you hear that story? How did you find that out? What stories do your friends tell you about this? Where do you get your information? You're always wanting to flesh out not just what happened, but how this person came to believe that's what happened. Another really important thing about oral history is that people started to mention in this room ways that oral history might benefit the interviewee. You have to be able to answer what the interviewee gets out of it. You can't say, it makes my radio show great. People want to hear the story. It's a great story. It's entertaining. That's not enough. Oral history will say that's not enough. Other documentary forms, I believe, are a little more sloppy about it. So often people say, well, what the interviewee gets out of it is their voice is amplified. You have to decide if that's enough for the interviewee. So we call this reciprocity in oral history. And reciprocity is a question that an oral history project design, which we'll talk briefly about, you say, you write a sentence, what my interviewees get out of this. Now, I'll give you some examples. First of all, without question, every interviewee should always get a copy of the full interview, regardless of what you do with it. So if you go and edit it down to a 5-minute thing that's going to be on the radio, that's great. But your interviewee should always get a record of the experience and collaboration that occurred in your interview. The other thing is you need to evaluate what else might be meaningful. So some of the examples of projects I mentioned, you might be interviewing people that you view as a group, but they might not be a cohesive group in real time and space. So for example, just because I interview toll booth collectors on, let's say, 5 different bridges, and they are a group to me, they might not be a group. So sometimes one of the forms of reciprocity is to bring people together and have a listening event, or to celebrate the project, or to bring people who aren't a cohesive group together. The public health study that I mentioned, going back to the creek between Brooklyn and Queens, the goal was to get people who've had health problems who have watched and felt very helpless about health problems affecting their community, was to get them to go out and be reporters and document the truth So they didn't feel like other people were telling them what was happening and what wasn't happening. And then to get them to interview people in Queens on the Brooklyn side and vice versa, so to get some community action and organizing going, so to galvanize. So that's one of the things that a community-based project can do. It can actually create a community by this form of participatory interviewing. Are there any questions so far? I know I'm talking about a lot of different kinds of projects.
We're trained to listen to a certain ear for the style of radio that's being, you know. But what you were suggesting was that you need to, in some of these instances, you must change that style so you add a dimension that is more objective and appealing to the listener. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, so Alan, I'm glad you brought that up, because let's get to training now. Let's get to the style. This question of what makes an oral history interview different from journalistic interviews, so when you leave this room, you can try some of these things, and you're going to try them with each other too. So we will get back to some of these other things, but I'm just going to tell you what's on page one is why collect oral histories, and I feel like you guys have collectively come up with this list to add to the record, to add voices that haven't been heard, to pass stories down, to find contradictions, to amplify the power of a voice, to explore the story through a group of voices, which we'll talk about. Now, what I'd like to do is talk about really the characteristics of an oral history interview. So let's go down to the bottom of page one. And I'm going to talk about some of, you know, maybe the eight most significant qualities that distinguish an oral history interview from a journalistic interview. Now, if you leave this room and the only two things you remember are open-ended questions and silence, I would be really happy, because that will radically change your interview. Mm-hmm. And it sounds very basic, but it's very, very, very hard. So a lot of these ideas are basic, but the training is intensive. So that means that you have to practice over and over. So open-ended questions probably sounds fairly explanatory, but it means you presume nothing. That means down to the point where you don't even say, what did you dream last night, as an icebreaker, because you don't presume that that person dreams. Mm-hmm. Everyone should be able to succeed at every question. No one should ever have nothing to say. If you are doing your job, any question should be able to be approached by the interviewee. So that means, for example, at the beginning of every interview, instead of saying, tell me about your family, You start with a question like, tell me about where you come from. Now, again, you know, I've done some journalistic interviewing, and that's a really painfully humble question. Tell me where you come from. It doesn't sound very clever or exciting, but the beauty of tell me where you come from is that someone can answer that in so many ways, and you can allow the interviewee to choose to go back to the town that person comes from, the family background, religious background. So what you're doing is allowing your interviewee to make choices, and you are noting carefully those choices. Your interviewee is telling you within the first 5 minutes what he or she is interested in and what he or she cares about. And that's what you're going to follow. So, yeah.
The question that's coming to mind for me that I'm not clear of is, does that mean that you shouldn't be asking, like, I know, I understand open-ended questions, but should you be asking challenging questions of people, or are you trying to make people, you're saying like people should feel comfortable to answer the question. Does that mean you don't want to really like press deep into issue? Like how, that's the balance I'm trying to figure out.
That's a great question, because if you do have an eye or ear toward a radio piece and you really do have some agenda, what you want to do is think about what challenging means. So it's not necessarily the question, that driving question in a journalistic interview where you say, but before you said such and such, you really believe. It's not that you're ever trying to pin someone against the wall, but a challenge in an oral history interview might be someone's telling you a really painful story, and a challenge might be, have you ever told this story before? And then someone starts telling you, no, I've never told this story before, or a challenge might be, have you always felt this way? So the challenge is, it comes in a different package. But the results, I should say that overall, the reason you're doing this, aside from empowerment and ethics, is to get people speaking anecdotally. So when I'm not teaching oral history in a setting like this, I teach undergrads and graduate students, and my favorite thing is to teach graduate documentary filmmakers, because they've already really absorbed a way that they think is a very searing way to ask questions. And they hate the idea of asking questions like, tell me where you come from. Mm-hmm. But then when they go out and do it, they always get better stories, because the idea is to get someone to move from rehearsed memories and rehearsed stories to anecdotal stories. So that's what a rich interview is, when people are freely associating and they're not conscious anymore about the organization, and then you organize it as a producer. But you're giving someone the experience to freely narrate non-sequentially. Yeah.
I think that's the part that's really hard in the position of an interviewer, is that the idea of what bottom-up history really is you are not dictating the story, and that you have to take direction from your interviewee.
Yeah.
And I think that's a power and control dynamic that's very hard for people with a lot of experience in telling stories or shaping or editing or creating stories, to cede that really control to somebody else, that sense of agency.
Yeah. I agree, and I think it really takes doing it and seeing the results to be completely converted.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, so I hope to convert you today, but the open-ended questions, to give you some more examples, you don't have to remain blank or ask generic questions. You can really respond to material. So if someone says, blah, 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 you know, let's say someone's telling a story about, you know, a war experience, you can go in to that story, but it's always coming from the narrative that he or she has laid out. Does that make sense? So it doesn't mean you have to stay generic or general. It just means that the material is generated by the interviewee and you are always responding to it. So, like, if you were to train for a year in oral history, you know, a lot of people compare it to psychoanalysis in terms of the kind of listening you do. So it's active listening, and you're always responding to the interviewee. So hopefully we'll get back to this question of where the challenge occurs. Some of you might be doing an oral history about a particular topic. So how do you balance this idea of an interview gone wild and a topic? So I will tell you, you know, the tool that I use. So sometimes I'm doing a life history, and then I can go wherever the person wants it to go. But sometimes I have a subject that I am interviewing someone about. So in that case, what I do is I always start with a life history component, and that's for historical purposes. We are not doing surveys. We're trying to find out what people believe or think and who they are. So we don't know who they are. We don't understand exactly what the context is socially. So I always start by saying, you know, we're here today to talk about the history of the pocketbook factory. But before we even get to the pocketbook factory, I'd love to find out a little more about you. Let's start. Tell me a little bit about where you come from. Now, placing that marker, it's basically always telling your interviewee where you will be going, so you are not completely in control. We're going to start with a little bit about you, then we're going to talk about the pocketbook factory. In my experience, the personal story will start to move toward the pocketbook factory if you set up that beachhead. And if it doesn't, you listen, and at the end of, like, usually a life history is about 20 minutes of an hour interview. You don't have to use your watch, but that's generally proportionately. Every oral history contains a life history component. So even if you're talking about, if you want to find out about someone's opinions of whether Bliss Towers here in Hudson should be raised or not, before you even get to the subject of Bliss Towers, before we talk about Bliss Towers, I'd love to find out a little more about you. You might brainstorm what questions are interesting, what kinds of life history questions are relevant to your topic. You might decide that questions about religion, race, class, education, you might brainstorm ahead of time what kinds of life history components would affect someone's opinions
about this time, this place. So far, just to go over, open-ended questions and a life history component are both part of every oral history interview. Are there any questions so far about that? Okay, do you want to talk about the history? Does anyone in this room who lives in Hudson want to define or talk about what Bliss Towers is?
Sounds nice.
Anyone?
I don't want to say it, you know, four other times, so somebody else can tell.
This is what I've heard. And then, you know, Hudson accepted them. And what else do I know? They've been here since the 70s. There were a lot of people kind of moved up. They were promised to have jobs up here. A lot of people moved up from the city to those projects. And I don't know what's happening with them now at this point. I actually don't know the situation right now, but I do know that, yeah, there's been controversy about them.
Yeah, well, the controversy, I'll follow up.
Yeah.
The controversy is that there's a plan to tear down these projects and to gentrify the area that they call the ghetto from 4th Street down to the river, which is an area where there was some moderate renovation, building of homes, like my grandparents' home is no longer there. But there's a big controversy about, you know, where people are going to go after they tear down Bliss Towers. And most of these people who came here came from the South in the 40s and 50s to pick fruit. They were fruit farm workers, and they came from the South, went back in the South in the fall, in the winter, then came back in the summertime. And then the economy was not good for them in the South, so they began coming here and staying here, hoping for a better life. And then the cement plants and other, you know, industries that were in Hudson began to close down. And so they were left with this poverty-stricken community, of which Bliss Towers was the project building. I don't call it a ghetto, because if you can't buy a loaf of bread from a black man, it ain't no ghetto. Okay? And you can't buy a loaf of bread from a black man below 4th Street. You can't buy a quart of milk. You can't buy a damn thing. Okay, except drugs.
So I think the subject of Bliss Towers' history and future is a great example locally of a really rich subject for oral history, because I'm reading things on blogs locally. I'm not hearing from Tower residents. Mm-hmm. So the oral history project starts with, tell me about the experience of living in this tower. Tell me how you came here. Tell me what you want to happen. So it's basically expanding the dialogue, getting it on the record, so regardless of what happens, it's on the record how Tower residents feel and felt. And it's also offering solutions. It's problem solving. So oral history can be used to problem solve. What do you think should happen? There's also what I love about oral history, which is on this list, is that oral historians are interested in contradictions and inaccuracy. Journalists are not. So if someone says something incorrectly about a date, a journalist just corrects it in the article. Oral history, we're interested, why does everyone have the wrong date? We're collecting that. We are documenting that. We are documenting contradictions, and the beauty is you don't have to synthesize all of them. They can live side by side. You can have a radio piece with 10 people saying, Bliss Towers has been here for 10 years. Bliss Towers has been here for 15 years. Bliss Towers has been, you can put those side by side to document the fact that people don't know the history. You don't have to correct. That is gold. Contradictions and inaccuracies are gold for oral historians, so I'd say that's a difference. You never correct your interviewee. You're more interested in how this person came to believe or think about this subject this way. Silence.
Silence is so important in oral history, and it's painful. We are so socially obedient, and we don't want to make our interviewees uncomfortable. And often what we do is we ask another question as soon as an interviewee looks lost, or we offer two questions if the person isn't picking up on a topic. So this is something that helped me early on. You have your friends listen to your interviews, and someone told me really early on, you keep asking double questions because I didn't think the person looked happy with the first question. And sometimes they're just thinking. Don't assume you know what someone's facial expression means, and let them tell you, I don't get that. So what you really want to do is practice silence, and if someone listens to your interview, there should be strong, like, 3-second silences. Often if someone gives an answer, the first stab is kind of the rehearsed part, and then if you offer 3 seconds of silence and nod your head, like, I'm still listening, they continue. I promise you, if you try that, it will be effective. And it's a lot harder than it sounds because you just don't want anyone to be uncomfortable. But sometimes I literally have students practice counting 1, 2, 3. And if you're answering before 3, it's too early. And I have my own nodding gesture, like, I'm still listening to you. You can develop your own. It should be silence. There's not a You want to avoid crosstalk where you talk on top of each other. But silence is really important. Another way, if you
I have a question about that. How does that work if you're talking to someone not face to face, or does oral history require that you're in the same room as the person?
It doesn't require. I mean, there have been like different schools of oral historians who are really against video oral histories, but now it's all changing. People are doing Skype interviews.
Or is that not?
Yeah.
Because then, like, that sort of like nodding, like the silent thing doesn't work. You want to use an oral cue to be like, yep, I'm here.
I think the ideal situation is always to be able to see someone because that rapport is so important. But I wouldn't not do an oral history if it has to be done over the phone. And I would say ahead of time, I'm really going to do this oral history style, so there might be some long silences. I'm still listening to you. You know, I would just announce something like that. Cell phones are really bad audio quality, and some of you might notice you talk over each other more when you're listening to when you're on a cell phone. So I don't know if the radio station is going to have a phone hookup or not, but we'll find out. Another thing, if someone gives you a short answer and you know there's more, sometimes I just say, interesting, tell me more. Or, you know, why do you think that happened is really important, because there are two components to every interview, what happened and what it means. And again, a lot of journalism is concerned with what happened. Oral history is really concerned with the interviewee. Why do you think this happened? What do you think it means? What do you think will happen in the future? Whether they're talking about their own lives or the community. Are there any questions about that? Like, how many of you listen to This American Life on public radio? Okay. So you might have already noticed this. If you don't, next time you listen, every This American Life radio piece is divided into two parts, what happened and what it means, some revelation by the protagonist or narrator of the story. Once you know this, you will hear it like two halves. And that's been their template for a long time. And a good oral history interview also has those two components, what happened and what does it mean? Like, tell me about your family, and then ask some questions, like, what do you make of that? Or, you know, if you have an interviewee who's really reticent and just a little shy, ask them to make a comparison. Comparisons are really great for getting people to tell longer stories. So if someone says something like, I'm just really anxious every day, I feel like, you know, my job is like, you know, my job won't exist in a year, you ask a question like, how would you compare how you feel today to 5 years ago? Tell me what it was like 5 years ago. And then it requires the person to do some storytelling, not just fill in short answers. So comparisons are really great. The last few things I want to talk about in terms of oral history training, silence, open-ended questions, get the interviewee speaking anecdotally by using comparisons, or asking something like, is there anything I haven't asked you about, is usually a good question for the end. And then one thing I want to talk about, for those of you who are interviewing people about seemingly negative experiences or negative events, such as if you're doing war interviews or if you're doing an interview surrounding a traumatic event, do not pathologize the situation or your interviewee's experience. I don't know if this is relevant for all of you, but oral history does often approach difficult subjects, and you don't want to assume that it was entirely negative for the interviewee. So that means, like, when I was doing interviews about 9/11, I didn't assume until I heard from my interviewee what was positive and what was negative about the day for that person. So you always give your interviewee room to talk about something positive, whether it's war or trauma or... Okay, we talked about social networks. Who do you talk to about this? Who told you that? Where do you get your information from? Like, locally, that's really important. Like, how did you find out about this event? Reciprocity, I started to mention. So forms of reciprocity are always giving an interview back to your interviewee, sometimes creating an event to bring your interviewees together. Sometimes there are other forms of reciprocity, allowing, I want to mention the oral history chain letter is an interesting structure that might be of interest to you here or in other communities. I had a student who wanted to do her oral history project on sexual assault, and she had been assaulted and told her story. And as she told her story, she was actually a little bit alarmed that every woman she told a story to had been assaulted and they had not told her. And so she thought, every woman knows one person who's been assaulted. I'm going to interview someone, pass my equipment on to that person. That interviewee is going to become interviewer and interview another person, and they passed the interview process along. Does everyone understand the structure? So whether you literally pass the equipment down or not, there was kind of a theoretical thing that matched that project that actually everyone got to be interviewer and interviewee. And regardless of the subject, I think the oral history chain letter might be a useful model for community interviewing. Lastly on this list, problem solving, that's always a big part of oral history.
Sorry, yeah. Can I just ask, did they, as part of the interviews, ask where they got the equipment, you know, who gave them the equipment, and who they were passing it to? Was that part of the interview?
No, I think each person, so this student interviewed someone and then basically supported, went to facilitate, was listener as that interviewee then interviewed. Does that make sense? So sometimes it helps to have a quiet person run the equipment so you don't have to worry about it. So there was always like a three. So if
and
any of you are,
support,
yeah,
so.
Yeah, technical and, yeah. You know, facilitating. So if you guys want to talk about that more, I'm happy to talk about that structure. Yeah.
If you have somebody who is doing this with technical work, and you're doing the interviewing, to what degree does that technical person have to stay silent? In other words, if that person is also involved in the production and, you know, I'm just curious, I guess it depends on what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I have a few different thoughts about that. I know, are you and Max, you're doing a show together, right? Okay. So I have a few different thoughts about the silent third person, so for example, StoryCorps booth, if you are familiar with StoryCorps in New York City, they have someone working on the equipment who occasionally jumps in. I personally like a silent party running the equipment with headphones on, also to literally listen to the sound levels and to say, I'm here, but I'm here as like a witness, quiet person. I think that person can be helpful to later talk to you about what happened in the interview, and I always leave the option at the end of every interview to say, would you be willing to be re-interviewed? So that might be something that, like, you and, you know, in your case, you and Max could talk about how the interview went and what to do next time. But other people, I mean, it's really up to what you think, how it feels to have a third person there. Yeah. Yeah, this is, I've seen this dealt with in a bunch of different ways. There have been a lot of papers written about, so do you mean if you and the interviewee speak two different languages and you have a translator? So So the translator, I've heard a journalist say, you know you have a good translator if the translator's not changing pronouns, really speaking in first person as the interviewee speaking. You want to make sure that the translator is literally translating in first person. And then there's been a lot of, I haven't had this experience, but there's been a lot written about like the setup. So you should always be looking at your interviewee, even if the translator is to the side. And obviously that translator would have to participate. So I don't know, how many people are dealing with potentially issues of a translator? Okay. So I'd be happy to pass along some resources. I haven't personally had that experience, but people have written quite a bit about using a translator. Yeah.
I'm seeing video clips of where interactive television has been used in the medical world, where it's imperative that the translator see the patient, the doctor, and the translator in one room, the patient is somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
The patient sees the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor sees the patient. The translator is the voice. But
yeah.
The viewing, the eye contact is between the patient and the doctor, and I think that's probably a parallel for the interview.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot that happens physically between an interviewer and interviewee, so a lot of you have probably already experienced that. But that eye contact is important.
It's
yeah.
Also, in my experience, important that you work with the interpreter, not a translator, is the correct term. Translation is for written material, and interpretation is in the live setting.
Mm-hmm.
I find it's always useful to talk to the interpreter about the best way to phrase the questions.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about oral history, it's really important that your questions be specific, you know, in terms of their open-endedness or whatever, but are phrased in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to make sure that the interpreter is sort of on the same page with that. And that what you're trying to go for and the decisions and choices that they make as an interpreter to ask those questions. Because they might themselves be not getting the gist of the question, but in fact interpreting it word for word, which will give another meaning or context to what you're really attempting to do, which is open space for your interviewee to answer in the way that they want.
Yeah, and I want to mention there is an International Oral History Association. And there is a listserv that's H_oralhist, if you just Google that, H_oralhist. And there are international oral historians all over. If you are going to another country, you might want to work with an interpreter who's trained. Just like an oral historian transcriptionist is a little bit different than another kind of transcriptionist. So, so again, those are resources I can point you to. Even though this is a really large group, I might want to do something in a few moments where we do an exercise with each other. Are there any other questions so far?
I
yeah.
I have a question. I'm just thinking this through because I remember interviewing someone and I wanted to know about like a riot that had happened in the 40s that they'd been in. And I was interviewing them and they kept like going and talking about these other things from their lives. And some of it was like interesting, and some of it was like these were the TV shows, and it just wasn't interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But like, if I was an oral historian, would I be thinking like, oh, gold, or would I be like, is there still this ability to be like, okay, let's steer back to like the riot that you were in? Like, how much can you direct? Like, you're saying like let the person direct the conversation, but how much can you direct, and how much can you should you just be like, if they want to talk about that, that's cool. Even if you think that they were mentioning something really interesting that was dynamic, like that's
mm-hmm.
the instinct in me is wanting to be like, let's steer back to this thing. But like that's steering, so like what's the balance to that?
So I think what I do is really getting back to laying down those beachheads, even though you have to accept that you might not get to the subjects you anticipate or desire, you still want to mention. It's fair to mention your interest. I'm particularly interested in the riots in, did you say the 40s? Riots in the 40s, I don't know if we'll get to that today, but hopefully we will. You know, you're being transparent about some of your interests and some of the subjects you hope to cover. You should notice someone's resistance, though. And
is it more like rambling like, than resistance? Like someone who just, like was just like, they once they started talking, it just like, the tangent just went wherever they wanted, and like, I kept feeling like I needed to steer it back to something that was like, you know, for me, like, I just wanted to interview about this subject, but like, even in general, I felt like this person, like, the way they talked, they weren't going to stay on point ever, like for a question, they were going to go off on something, and then it was like every question was like sort of bringing it back because they were suddenly talking about like, have you ever watched Bonanza? Like, and it was like, that wasn't what I wanted to know about, was like plot of a TV show. But like, I don't know, like, is that something that was like, I guess I'm trying to like put my head in, what does this mean, oral history? If someone's like, I want to talk about Bonanza and like who the celebrities were or whatever, like, I don't think that tells me a lot about their life or what. But maybe I should be like, that's what's important to them. Like, I don't know. I'm just like, that's the balance that I'm trying to.
I'll tell you my thoughts, and I'd love to hear other thoughts based on your experience, too. I would test that resistance a little further, still giving them open-ended questions, but I would find a segue to really explore whether it's just anxiety and nervous rambling or whether they're really avoiding, you know? So I would find a time, like, I don't know the context of the interview. But I would say it's really interesting to hear about, like, you've really done a great job of telling me about some of the popular culture in the 50s and 60s. I'm really interested also in what was going on politically or what was going on, what can you tell me about the 40s? Then if they avoid it, I would say that's avoidance. Yeah. You know, sometimes people are just trying to fill the space. But I would really try and make a connection, a comment that you've been listening. So it's interesting, I didn't know about Bonanza, you know? And then you say, going even a decade back before that, what could you tell me about the political or social things going on in your town or about your experiences? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Then I think you're gonna get a clearer picture of what's going on. What about, yeah.
Yeah, I kind of was curious if you had some suggestions for techniques for kind of the opposite situation. I work with a lot of people who are interviewed quite often by journalists, especially international journalists, about things that happen in their communities, and they sort of just like get onto their, this is what I say to journalists.
Their spiel.
They just like have their deal, this is what's happening, it's this person's fault, like they get real into whatever.
Yeah.
And how do you, like, what would you suggest as different tools or questions to sort of like break them out of their like automatic narrative?
First question, you've been interviewed so much. I'd like to hear what you haven't had a chance to talk about in your interviews. What haven't you told any journalist before? This interview is going to be a little bit different. You know?
You know, the reporters, the journalists, in certain communities, they know what to ask. They know how to phrase your response so it's acceptable to the public because of their readers. So sometimes, you know, it kind of alters your energy when you're being interviewed because you really can't give them your heartfelt response because you know it's not what's going to appear in the newspaper. And depending upon what commitment you live in. I blow them off. So they call some other black person, get a black perspective from them. They ain't gonna get mine. I wanted to add before that, you know, the best interviewer I've seen has been Bill Moyers. The worst I've seen is Larry King. Now, Larry King makes a whole lot more money than Bill Moyers does. And another thing I wanted to say, but there are different styles in interviewing than there may be in collecting oral history data from the interviewee. So, for example, if you were in the Cold War Russia, there are certain values or attitudes that you would avoid, you know, when interviewing someone there about their life experience there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you might go to some other place on the planet and it'd be a whole different posture in interviewing there. So, I think in oral history, if you really want good oral history, you have to ask pretty much straight up questions and kind of as you interview, get a fix on the person's personality, you know, what makes them twinkle a bit, what makes them want to elaborate. Like last night, she got me. She asked me one question, and I answered 10 other ones, you know, and she kept asking me. But we got into a conversation as opposed to an interview. So I think that there are traps out there for you when you're doing oral history to stick to the script as best as you can because the trap is you're vulnerable to exploring other parts of the person's information base. It can be very fascinating.
something there.
But I think you want that. I think you do. You know, I really discourage scripts because I think you should have a blank piece of paper, and this takes training and it takes like a little bit of steel nerves. But the beauty of it is, like, you need to be well rested and like on your game instead of having written 40 great questions. And I get really nervous before an interview, and I'm like, I just have to really be present and be a good listener. It's very weird and counterintuitive to the other kinds of jobs we do, that what it means to do a good job is really, like, to be listening, not distracted, and to be, like, you know, not preparing the next question while you're listening. And, you know, there are tricks, like, you know, therapists learn tricks of how to stifle a yawn, and oral historians learn those tricks too, because actually it's a very common physical response if someone's telling you a very terrible, upsetting story to feel like you have to yawn. I've done it before. I've done it when I teach. I don't know. You can either cough or you learn. There's a way to move your mouth. I mean, there's a way to do it.
Yeah, you swallow exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe if someone yawns, I'll do it. But there are also another thing I want to say that comes up is people might tell you something terrible that you disagree with and say something like, you know what I mean? And they might have told you something that you find ethically, like, horrendous. And it's a really interesting moment, and I really encourage you to interview people that you feel aligned with and don't feel aligned with. That's how you train. People that you are part of a group and you are not part of a group. You should be an insider and an outsider. That's part of training. And someone might say something like, well, I can't think of an example, but they'll just say something like, you know, just that offends you. And they say, you know what I mean. They want to know if you're with them. And you learn a noise like, you know, like, I'm still listening. I'm listening to you, but I'm not going to say yes or no, you know. And I've had to do it several times. And there's a great essay, again, like, I'm going to pass around. Maybe I'll pass it around now if you give me your email. There's a great essay called Evidence, Empathy, and Ethics. And it's by an historian, a white lesbian Marxist historian who decided to interview female members of the Klan. And it's all about the ethical issues she had and how she dealt with them and how she dealt with moments when people are telling her stories. And it's a really beautiful essay about ethics. So those of you who are particularly interested in ethical issues, and she talks about why it was important to document these stories. Evidence, Empathy, and Ethics, and I'd be happy to send it to you. I have a PDF, so if you leave an email address. Hey, Laura,
I just had another question about follow-up questions. What do you do when you begin to see a theme developing? This is a little different, because my training's in anthropology, so we're not producing a product in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing oral history, do you follow that theme directly by following up and saying, you know, I see that it seems like most of your life you're interested in these risky occupations. Do you do that, or do you, like, directly highlight the theme that you see emerging, or do you kind of keep your ear open to that and try to get on questions that go around the continue this theme?
Okay, that's a great question. So let's say you are noticing something that seems really obvious to you. So let's use Laura's example of if someone's been in all these high-risk occupations. I think you would seize upon the theme, but instead of saying, I notice you've been in all these high-risks, you say, do you see any connection between the kinds of jobs you've had? And if they don't, you know, that's a good question of whether, yeah.
I have a question about having that tabula rasa, fancy piece of paper.
Yeah.
So what I would be concerned about is that as someone is telling me a story and I think, oh, I really want to ask about that detail, but then the person keeps talking, I'll forget that question. Do you write down your questions on a piece of paper as the person's talking?
Okay, so I'll show you, like, the nuts and bolts part of this workshop. I'll just show you literally what I do. You guys can make
up your own. But this is like, you'll see on the sheet, which we're not going to have time to go all the way through, but I'm like, do not sit on a sofa when you interview someone, because in 20 minutes you'll not be able to move your neck. And also do not drink and eat, because it's really upsetting later to hear, like, you know. And so basically I always use a table corner, always, and I always have my lap and the table. And let's say this is my interview. I always put a blank piece of paper here. So this would be blank. I have my recorder here, and I like to use lavalier mics. And I have a list of like many ways you can record on this sheet. So if you want to use an iPhone, there are field recorders. There are apps you can put on your iPhone now. There are mics that can go into an iPod. So look at this. But I put my recorder here. I always use lapel mics. I always wear headphones with one ear on, one ear off. And I tell the interviewee, I'm completely listening. I have one ear on to make sure the sound level's okay. Lavalier mic. And then I have one piece of paper. It might look like this. And I'll have like four words on it and no more. The interviewee should be able to see this. It's like nothing is secret from your interviewee. Oral history is like you're just completely transparent. And I even say, you know, when we're talking, I might write a few words down, things I want to get back to. So let's say like someone's like telling this really upsetting like childhood story about her dog. And then we go way off. I just might write like dog, you know, to remind myself to get back to it. You don't want to start writing like this, because if any of you have had that experience, or if your teacher suddenly like, all your students are writing something, and you're like, why weren't you taking notes the last hour? But it makes you feel really weird. So I just like will write a few notes here, and I'll have four things I want to get to. So I think you mentioned like the 40s riots. Like I would write 40s riots down. Like the four things I really couldn't live without leaving, you know, with some mention
for you
of.
Or so that they know that's what you want to talk about. For
me.
They're like looking at your paper. That
no, for me. But I might just say, I say everything, because I've had some negative experiences, especially if you've interviewed journalists. So I interviewed like an editor of New York Review of Books at post 9/11, and he was clearly so annoyed by my questions because they were really, you know, they're not terribly clever. They're like, tell me about where you come from, you know? And so at some point we stopped the interview, and I was like, look, I'm really taking an oral history approach. The questions are open-ended for a reason. You know, he said, I'm used to having conversation. You know, journalistic, you're looking for some of that friction, you know? And oral history is just collaboration. And so I have told students, if you feel really weird about asking these general questions, announce it at the beginning. Like, I'm going to be asking you some questions. They're really open-ended. Yeah.
I have a question that kind of segues into that, which is this idea of collaboration. And for you as an oral historian, how much of yourself do you reveal in your interview process? Like, when I was trained in oral history, it was like, you know, reveal nothing, like you're not in this. But I'm also a subject, I'm also a person that's interacting mm-hmm. with the people I'm interviewing. Mm-hmm. So I found this past year when I was doing more and more oral histories, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I can relate to that because this one time with me, blah, 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 and this is my experience. And then that was like, oh yeah, and then it sparked and sparked and sparked, and that I felt so much more in it. But is that kind of unethical in a way, leading a person along?
Well, these are just this is my methodology. So when you guys leave, you'll adapt some of this for your purposes. I am a person who like doesn't tell someone anything about myself. I don't resist. If they're like, where are you from? I'm not like, I can't talk about that. But I am like really like, this is your time. And I don't want them to orient any of their answers to what they anticipate my political, social, I really don't want them to try and be obedient. Believe me, your interviewees are already picking up so many cues. The second they see you, they're making all kinds of assumptions. I don't want to add any more. So one thing that I want to bring up about the 9/11 interviews, and that I want to bring up about your subjects, is that an oral history story, unlike a journalistic story, is not looking for the most sensationalist, best story. You're looking for an accurate range of experiences.
So when we did 9/11 interviews, I'm sorry, my back is. When we were doing 9/11 interviews, we were literally looking in New York City for a person who would say it didn't affect me that much. We wanted to find that person. We were not looking for the person running out of a burning building. You wanted to find everyone. We didn't find that person, but we're not convinced there wasn't a person. We didn't think anyone wanted to say it, you know, on tape. So as much as possible, you want to make it easy for someone to say things that, you know, without feeling like you're the kind of person who wouldn't agree with that. Or, but I have friends who feel more like what you just said, who feel like they like, before they start the interview, to tell them a little about themselves. I don't. I really, really don't. You know, I'm shy. That's why I'm an interviewer. And I feel like I don't really want to talk about myself. And I also feel like it helps them just talk about their story.
Is there a word for the effect when you listen to yourself on tape and you don't like it? I mean, because, like, I mean, when I interject in interviews, I always like, oh, why did I say that? Or it's like, it sounds silly.
Well, I mentioned I've been interviewing.
Over and over.
I don't know. But everyone feels that way, interviewer and interviewee. And you just get used to it. The more interviews you do, you start, like, you kind of let your ego down a little bit, and you're like, did I get the job done? Did I find, you know? I just started interviewing toll booth collectors on the Rip Van Winkle Bridge, and then I sent some of them have the interviews now, and one already listened to the whole thing, and he wrote back that he was really tired, and he was very concerned, and I wrote him back, and my first step was to reassure him of the ways in which I thought the interview was rich. And then I don't know what he'll think, like, whether that will be enough. You know, he didn't think he did a good job. I really do. So what will happen? I don't know what will happen next. You know, I just wrote him yesterday. I think the interview was incredibly rich. Yeah.
No, like, journalistically, you never give your source your product until it's, like, finished and out there, and there's no sort of going back to it. Oh, I should have said it this way, or, oh, wait, like, I sound bad doing that? Like, what is oral history? What are the ethics of sending raw material?
So there are release forms, and actually there are copies of these release forms. I really encourage you. I'm running something downstairs called the speech bubble. It's like that blue curtain thing in the parking lot where you can practice interviewing someone for 5 minutes. And we have release forms there if you want to take a look at what a release form looks like. So my feeling about an oral history interview is that the interview never gets erased or redacted, any of it. But if you're going to put something on the air, you have to have someone's permission about the edited version, not in process, but when you're done with it. So that's like what I'm working on now. My release form said the oral history interview will be complete, archived, possibly at WGXC. The like any edited version will be approved by the interviewees, but that's partly because, like, some of them said names, and, you know, journalistically you don't have to do that. But in the 9/11 interviews, some lawsuits started, and these interviews could be subpoenaed. So we did give people the opportunity we suppressed the audio and we blacked out names in the transcript, but you never ever want to erase audio. You can close the audio, you can not allow people to listen to the audio, but you never ever want to erase the historical document. The transcript, there's a history of Black Panthers project right now, there are legal problems, and the names are blacked out on the transcript and the audio is closed right now. Does that help at all? Or does anyone want to think of a specific problem like that?
One thing that you can do is, I know you can take an interview and then let it not be available for like 60 years. And then so after 60 years, the interview is now open in the archive. But before 60 years, it's closed because the information is open. I think that's a wonderful.
Yeah, I do too, and I think that any of these interviews you guys are doing, even if you're really gearing it toward radio, you should really think about places that the full interviews might be of value or of use. WGXC has a website, for example. There are public libraries, so you might think of places where the full interviews could be archived. And again, on the sheet, there's a thing like, where do oral histories live? So there, I have a list of some places that oral histories can live as the full document before you make the radio piece or after you make the radio piece. I'm wondering if we have time to do, do you guys want to try this exercise for 10 or 15 minutes?
I want you to keep talking.
Tell me
more.
Tell
me more about oral history.
Okay.
Can I ask
a
question?
Okay.
Just in terms, I don't know if you're going to, are you going to talk about editing?
That can be my question.
Yeah, I have, yeah. Is that a request?
I just, if you're saying the basic interview is about an hour.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of material.
What is your, yeah, what is your process in terms of turning that into something that's kind of 15 minutes?
Okay, so it takes a long time. There are a lot of different styles in terms of what you want to do with your material. You get an hour interview, maybe it's an hour and 15 minutes. You need to think whether it's based on the material you got or based on your own aesthetics, your own audio interests, whether you want to create a monologue, whether you want to create a condensed interview, or whether you want to create a radio doc that has narration, actualities, like that. So you want to think about which audio model you want to follow. So I would point you to, if you want an example of radio pieces that are like way more oriented toward oral history than traditional radio doc, Sound Portraits, David Isay's Sound Portraits. There are two pieces I'm thinking of right now that I feel like are really heavy on the chorus of voices and very light on the narration and production. So Remembering Stonewall is a piece that has very little interruption by producers or narration, and also Witness to an Atomic Bomb might be really interesting to oral historians in the room, because Witness to an Atomic Bomb is a woman who was, it's two interviews. A woman who was interviewed after the atomic bomb was dropped in Japan, and then she was interviewed 60 years later. So it's two interviews, the piece. Her voice sounds different, her memories are different, and her perception. So it's really, to me, I use it in my oral history class all the time to talk about memory and voice. So those are two examples of things made from oral history. Also, those of you who like Studs Terkel, T-E-R-K-E-L, a book like Working is made entirely of monologues that came from interviews. And there's an NPR piece where Studs Terkel, you can hear the original interviews, which I really recommend. If you like the monologues on text, in text, you might really like to hear the interview. He's interviewing a waitress and a housewife. And it really gives you an idea of what he was working with. I'm right now going to be making monologues from the interviews I'm doing. If you live locally, I'm happy to show you as I'm working on it. But you have a bunch of different choices or models. I'm trying to think of what else, how else I can address the editing question. I guess.
How long does it normally take from an hour to
Well. Here's the thing, if you are really interested in doing an oral history about a general subject, you decide what that kind of hard nut is in the interview that your radio piece is about. And what I do is listen to the whole hour and make a list of themes that come up, and I might only be using things related to one theme. It might be very easy to think about what audio to grab from that interview. There might only be 6 minutes from the full hour that address whatever the subject is. So I really recommend not transcribing the whole thing, although I love transcribing's great, but logging, just making a list of themes in order and then circling what I call the hot spots. You know, what do you think the hot spots of this interview are? They might not be what you expected. You might also take a bunch of interviews and find the place where every single person talks about the waterfront and put those all together, and you might have to do very little narration in between. You might create, you have so much room to create new forms. This could be a chorus of voices in Hudson about the waterfront. If you took 2 minutes from every interview that addresses the waterfront,
put them together and let people hear them. Yeah.
This is sort of tangential. I know you're not quite talking about transcripts, but there's two sort of similar issues I've dealt with both in broadcasting and in transcribing that I want to ask about in terms of how much to modify material. So if someone says ain't, I will transcribe that as ain't.
You will or
but
won't?
I will.
Yeah.
But if they cut off the G's at the end of the word, for example, do I do an apostrophe or do I write the G? It's a the question between readability versus being true to someone's speech, a dialect or accent or something like that. Similarly, in broadcasting, I've been known to edit out all the hums and stutters of someone who's a compulsive stutterer because, it wasn't true to their speech, but it would have been unlistenable and unbroadcastable if I hadn't done that.
This is a very popular debate, and if you join H_OralHist, you'll be shocked by how emotional you can dig into these historical threads where people are just talking about whether to keep in ums or not. When I am teaching people to transcribe for the first time, I ask them to note speech patterns if I think they are culturally significant. Like, I've said like and for the last hour, but I don't think you'll hopefully leave this room remembering that. But there are other quirks that people have which are significant and specific, and I like to keep those in. At the same time, you want to maintain the intelligence of your interviewee, and if you feel like leaving all those in makes them sound quite different from how they sounded in person, then you might leave them out. But you always write down what decisions you've made about transcribing.
Yeah, I love the way you says sarcasm. I mean, that's an interpretive thing, or giggle, or pause, or whatever. It just makes me reading it a little funner, and like you're there at least. So that's a fun choice to make.
Yeah, if you're transcribing like brackets or your best friend, anything you put in brackets is like dog barked, or suddenly it got freezing, or sarcasm. So anything in brackets is stuff that you can include.
Nods, shakes head.
Yeah, body language. Yeah. Any questions about editing or other subjects? We have 5 or 7 minutes. Yeah.
I was wondering if you knew of any projects specifically using oral history interviews to create performances.
Yes. So do you want me to talk about projects that I have? So Anna Deavere Smith, who did a project called Fires in the Mirror, and if you get the script has been published with an introductory essay, so you can get the script, but you can get the published script with an essay. Get that version. I think like it might be like published by Vintage, and the essay describes her process. But basically, she created monologues verbatim from interviews and then performed as all these different characters. And she always chooses sites of conflict, so she's representing both sides. The Laramie Project, many of you might be familiar with, that was all created out of interviews. Vagina Monologues, Sarah Jones is Bridges and Tunnel. So there's a whole documentary theater tradition. There's also an essay on creating oral history in correctional settings where prisoners have created monologues and then performed them. There's an essay on that in the Oral History Reader. A really interesting example of using oral history and interviews is a play called I Am My Own Wife, written by Doug Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. There's a play called Having Our Say by Emily Mann, M-A-N-N. There's a really interesting history of documentary theater and oral history. And people call it things like theater of testimony. There are all these different names, ethnographic theater. Yeah.
I have a question, and I'm asking this more as someone who's a researcher than someone who is an oral historian, but I think it applies the other way too. But if I wanted to go and be like, who's doing a research on some topic, and I'm like, oh, I bet someone out there's done an oral history, like, are these all kept in one repository, or like, are there many places? Like, where do you look for the oral histories that have already been done? Because there must be thousands of them. And then the flip side of the question is, I guess, if you're an oral historian, where should you put your like open source and make your stuff available for people?
That's such a good question. And the last sheet of the thing I gave you, page 4, is project design worksheet. If you answer all these questions, you have a project design. And one of the questions that you have to ask is what's already out there. So don't just go do something you want to. I mean, I want you all to do what you want to do. But like, you should be contributing something that hasn't already been done, or you should be collaborating with someone who's doing it. So it's a good question. The problem with oral histories is they're like locked at universities. Websites are changing that because you can, through an internet search, find out where things exist. There's also something called Alexander Street Press. I don't know if you already use it. Maybe if you work at a university. It's called Alexander Street Press, and it's an index of oral history. There is, as part of it, an index of oral history projects, and it's one of the only places that indexes them. You could also, I'm always having to make bibliographies of oral history projects. You're welcome to ask me. I could ask someone else. You know, if you're curious what else is out there, feel free to email me. My email is on the bottom of this. Not that I know all, you know, by any means, but if you're interested in funding, I just want to say something. This is unfortunately very general, but I think you should really consider both funding for oral history and then funding for any related part of your subject. So oral history funding is not great. It's not a lucrative career to go out and be an oral historian. Many oral historians are psychologists or anthropologists or do other things, although there's some people who are professional oral historians. But there are funding sources. Like, I just got a small grant. So the Radcliffe Institute gives you a small grant if your project is related to women. So there are lots of oral history grants if it's related to a particular topic. I also recommend that you think about funding for your topic, you know, that might, aside from oral history. So there's a mental health fellowship, you know, the Rosalind Carter Fellowship. If you think your project's related to mental health, apply for the mental health funding. The Oral History Association, I strongly recommend you go to the website. You don't have to be a member. I encourage you to be a member. But there's a whole section on oral history funding there. If you do go to the city, there's also the Foundation Center where you can make an appointment and ask about oral history funding. What else? Yeah.
How much interest is there in it amongst the general public?
In oral history?
Yes.
I have noticed, I've been teaching oral history for, I think, like 5 years now. I have noticed, like, such a change. I used to have 5 people in my class because no one knew what it was, and now, like, it's just grown because I think the word's being, I think there are a few reasons. StoryCorps, I think, is bringing the term oral history to the general public. Also, there are a lot of books called The Oral History of Hip Hop, The Oral History of blah, blah, blah. And I think it's really coming into, you know, popular use, the term. So I've noticed, like, a major change in interest.
Just, you know, in terms of putting some of this on the radio, I'm just wondering how interested people, the audience, would be to hear it.
I think that while people don't, I've never heard people put, oh, I want to tell you about one project, if this is related. There is a woman I read about in the New York Times, and I contacted her, wrote her a letter, and met her because she was conducting interviews with ex-child soldiers from Liberia who are now living in Staten Island. And she was at first doing it for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She gave up on the TRC. The interviewees didn't trust the TRC, but she continued to interview. She started a radio show called Straight from the Heart, which is funded by the United Nations, and it airs in Liberia. And basically, she uses the interviews to broker conversations between victims and perpetrators who now live in the same town, so based in civil war in Liberia. But I'm just going to tell you about the radio show because this is a perfect example for all of you. She pre-records an interview. She has someone tell his or her story of what happened to him or her during the Civil War. They're terribly graphic stories. I've played some of them at events. And a story might be, you know, about how someone's limbs were cut off or a woman who was raped. And the person tells the story. It's pre-recorded. It's played on the radio show, and the host, Agnes, invites 3 experts into the studio to respond to the story.
So there'll be like a social worker, possibly someone from the Truth and Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and someone else, and they'll give their thoughts about the story, and then people call in and respond to the story. And sometimes the calls in are like, you know, keep on going, the same thing happened to me. Sometimes they're very basic, or I don't understand how she's going to continue living. And then, but there's this dialogue between the pre-recorded story, the people who call in, and then the people in the studio. So, you know, regardless, that's a particular subject, but that's one of the examples where I've heard longer stories aired. NPR, you hear 2-minute, 3-minute pieces, but some of you might experiment with playing longer pieces if there's an opportunity to respond, or, you know, I'd be really curious if people want to play with playing longer interviews.
How diverse can you be from the nationalized version of history versus the reality version of history, particularly with young people?
Wait, say the I missed the very beginning.
Well, how do you reconcile the nationalization and nationalized America's vision of itself in the world?
Yeah.
And the history, the way it was presented to people in their development, and the reality of what the actual history was, at the same time bring that to the awareness of children who don't seem to give a damn about history.
I think that a lot of these individual voices are correcting the record. That's what you're doing. The oral history is to amend the record, revise the record. I think you can make curriculum from these kinds of things. I think, you know, a lot of people are making educational materials from oral histories. And so I think that oral history is the tool to correct the record. You know, and I think what you're talking about, collective and individual memory, we don't have time to get into it, but collective memory, what used to be called national memory, are the versions of stories that we all hold together in order to be together, but then our individual memories might conflict. So in your own family, you might all walk around with the idea that so-and-so is the screw-up in your family. That's not really true. There's like this collective idea of, I don't know how to explain it in 2 minutes, but there's a collective memory and an individual memory, and a good oral history interview will get at both. We'll get at what do you think the popular opinion is, but what do you think the truth is? So I think it's important to document the way history has been taught, but also individuals who want to refute that record.
Like you're documenting mythology rather than memory.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's like, you know, where did you learn this? What stories do you hear? Yeah. Any other question? Sorry that I mean, ideally you guys would be doing more talking and interviewing. I'm going to be sitting in that interview booth with the blue curtains this afternoon, and you can come in, like, you can do it like a blind date. You just grab someone for 5 or 10 minutes, or you could look at the person next to you now and just go during lunch. Say, do you want to try and do it for 10 minutes? And what I'd love is you just tried out the open-ended questions in silence, because it's really hard. And then after, if you wanted help, I could help you. So if you want to do that, just sign up here, and maybe you don't even have to have an interviewee. You could sign up to be interviewer or interviewee. Would anyone come to the booth and visit me? Okay, I would love that. Great. Okay, any last questions?
Where do you teach at?
I teach at NYU New School, and then I also teach privately, like groups of people who want to learn about oral history.
Yeah. You're now based here.
I'm here. Yeah.
Very, very good.
Thank you so much.
That's great.
Oh, thank you.